Dear beloved on-demand listener, while listening to interviews during Issues Etc. 24, you'll hear appeals to join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. We want you to join. However, the phone number for you to join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club while you're listening on demand is 618-223-8385. 618-223-8385. Just disregard the 877 number given out during the broadcast. You can also join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club online, issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening.
Issues Etc. 24, Hour 15, starts now.
Well, here's a book that many Christians regard as largely irrelevant. Now, you'll hear Christians, especially pop American Christianity, within that pale. You'll hear them reference the book of Leviticus if they want to make a moral point about, say, homosexuality or adultery or something like that, because there are passages there in Leviticus that are quite clear, moral prohibitions against such thing, and good for them that they would hold fast to these teachings. And yet the same Christians might be aghast to discover that the worship life of the Old Testament people of God was, well, highly regulated down to the very smallest detail of their life on a daily basis throughout the course of the year, their offerings made at the tabernacle and later the temple, even the tabernacle and the temple themselves, the way that they were constructed and ornamented and how the priests would have their duties, all of these things dictated down to the detail in the book of Leviticus. And that runs against the grain of our way of thinking about worship. Worship is supposed to be all about freedom, all about anything goes. Maybe we've forgotten something about what the Old Testament people of God knew about the proper worship of God. Maybe we could even be so bold as to call it divine service, God serving us with the forgiveness of sins, and recapture some of what the Old Testament people of God did know, that there is a way to worship God that is centered upon his service to us in the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, and it really isn't anything goes or whatever we feel like. The book of Leviticus is the subject for the next 2 hours of Issues Etc. 24. Dr. John Kleinig joins us. You can as well, 1-877-623-MYIE. Hour 15 and 16 of Issues Etc. 24, covering the book of Leviticus, 1-877-623-6943. You can comment at our Issues Etc. Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Email us here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, or Twitter us at issuesetc. Joining us to talk about the book of Leviticus, Dr. John Kleinig of Australian Lutheran College and author of the Concordia Commentary on Leviticus. Dr. Kleinig, welcome back.
It's nice to be with you. Blessed Easter season for you.
And to you as well. This would really surprise, I think, a lot of Christians nowadays who have a view of Christian worship as something that is completely unregulated, completely without form, completely spontaneous, and kind of up to the individual worshiper, that the Old Testament worship of God's people, divine service, if you will, was so carefully specified by God himself. Your thoughts there?
Yes. It strikes one immediately when one comes from a modern point of view to New Testament and then Old Testament after that. One of the problems that we have is that when we talk about worship, we see it as something that we do. We worship God. We have a different story in the Old Testament, and particularly in Leviticus. There, the emphasis is on God coming to his people and meeting with them in the divine service. Now, for God to do that, he sets the agenda. The people don't set the agenda. And the most remarkable thing is, if we just take the book of Leviticus, it consists of 36 different speeches from God, and they cover various aspects of worship. Now, in these speeches, God gives his people the regulation for worship. He institutes the divine service through his word, and that same word then empowers the divine service so that God can deliver his blessings to his people. So the important thing that the story of the Old Testament gives us, that in worship, if we can use the modern term, God sets the agenda because God wants to deliver gifts to us. He's the one who determines the means by which we receive his gifts.
Is that still true today?
Very much so. Strikes us when we come from Old Testament to New Testament is that whereas there is many different instructions about worship, many different passages which institute various aspects of worship, there are much fewer things in the New Testament. But still, this applies as well. We don't determine how we celebrate Holy Communion. Jesus does by his word, for example. We don't decide what happens in worship. Jesus does so by his commands and promises.
How important is the concept of holiness in the book of Leviticus and, again, also for Christian worship today?
Yeah, very important. And that's one of the problems that we have in modern Western Christianity. Some years ago, I visited New Guinea, and I met with an ex-student of mine who had learned Hebrew with me here in Adelaide and then gone over to the U.S. to do a master's in a Lutheran seminary and then came back to New Guinea to teach there. Fairly soon after he'd come back, I met with him and asked him how things were over in the States when he was there. He hesitated for a long while and he said, "John, for them nothing is sacred any longer." It's a comment that I've never forgotten. We have problems in the church and problems in worship because we no longer have any sense. It's as if we've become colorblind to God's holiness. From beginning to end, worship has to do with God's holiness. God's holiness not something that we manufacture by ourselves, but something that God gives to us. So if we're going to make sense of worship in the Old Testament, and I'd maintain to the classical tradition of Christian worship, we have to understand the whole theology of holiness that is mapped out more clearly in the book of Leviticus than any other part of the Bible. And that's its great gift to the church, is that it gives a very clear teaching on holiness, and not in a theoretical way. So there's no abstract discussion about holiness there. But God establishes the tabernacle, the divine service, the priesthood, the congregation, and he, as it were, shows them what holiness is by the architecture of the tabernacle, the design of the service, the liturgical calendar, and everything else associated with the divine service. In this way, they learn God's holiness. And that's why it's important that God institutes the divine service. His word sanctifies the service and the people involved in the service.
I guess one of the first things we need to look at is kind of skipping ahead to Leviticus chapter 9, where the actual divine service of the Old Testament tabernacle worship was inaugurated when it was actually put into place. It begins with some rather major sacrifices. Why the shedding of blood for the beginning of the Old Testament divine service in Leviticus?
I'll come to the shedding of blood in a moment, but just the whole divine service and its inauguration. In Exodus chapter 29, God instituted the daily sacrifice of a lamb with a grain offering every morning, every evening. And that formed the heart of the divine service. Now, the book of Exodus ends with the consecration of the tabernacle and the entrance of God's glory into the Holy of Holies. And then you have a whole list of sacrifices that are God institutes in Leviticus chapters 1 through to 7. And then in chapter 8, you get the consecration of the priests. And then in chapter 9, you get the first performance of the divinely instituted service, the inauguration of the divine service. And it's a very, very complex ritual because it's the first time it's enacted. From then on, then, we have the divine service performed at the tabernacle and then later on the temple every morning, every evening, for as long as both tabernacle and temple last. And it is that service then that leads to the communion service in the church. So Leviticus 9 tells the story of its inauguration. We can come to the shedding of blood in a minute, but I'd like to first talk about the basic function of the divine service, if I may.
Please do.
Okay. You may remember that when the Israelites left Egypt, God accompanied them in the glory cloud. You remember the cloud, which was dark in the day and then lit up in the night. It went out before them and led them across the Red Sea and all the way to Mount Sinai. And then that glory cloud appeared once again on top of Mount Sinai. The glory of God was at the peak of the mountain, and the cloud itself covered the whole of the mountain. When the God revealed himself to the people, he did so in a strange way. He didn't do it the way the Israelites expected, coming from the pagan background, by showing his face to them, but he spoke to them from the cloud. And then Moses went on top of the mountain and received all the instructions about the tabernacle and the priesthood. Then when the divine service was inaugurated, the purpose of the divine service, according to God's word to Moses in chapter 9, verse 6, Moses said, "This is the thing that the Lord commanded you to do, that the glory of the Lord may appear to you." So the purpose of the divine service was for God's glory, which was hidden in the Holy of Holies, to appear to the assembled people at the altar in front of the tabernacle. And it did so in the form of fire. Fire came from the Holy of Holies onto the altar, and then it burnt up the offerings on the altar, all the whole list of offerings. And the people then saw the glory of God, God's presence, in the form of a cloud of smoke rising from the altar. So the purpose of the divine service was for God to show his glory, to show his presence, his grace to his people every morning, every evening. To put it another way, the purpose of the divine service is for heaven to come to earth, or people on earth to have access to God, not up in heaven, but at the altar every morning, every evening. If you like, the altar every morning and evening was replaced Mount Sinai as the place where God met with his people.
What did it mean that God would meet with them? I guess what one could wonder is, couldn't God's presence, since his holiness is absolute, be dangerous to his people? What about the divine service there assured the people that God was coming not to destroy, but in fact to show mercy.
Yes, and the whole of the order of the divine service served that purpose. They gave the people safe access to God. God's holiness is a bit like fire. If you bring gasoline in the presence of fire, that fire burns up gasoline. Well, God's holiness is a bit like light. If light comes into the presence of darkness, it dispels the darkness. So God's holiness is gracious, but it's also destructive. And the whole design of the divine service was divine service was arranged in such a way that the people had safe access to God's grace. Everything in the divine service served that end. Would you like me to go through the basic order?
Yeah, please do.
Okay. As I said before, the divine service focused on the offering of a male lamb together with some flour mixed with olive oil and incense on the altar every morning, every evening. Now, there were six stages to the order of the divine service. First of all, the priest on duty slaughtered the lamb and butchered it. And then the ritual began with the pouring out of blood from the lamb against the side of the altar. All the blood was drained from the lamb, and then the blood was splashed on all four sides of the altar. And in this way, atonement was made for the people. The purpose of atonement was to cleanse them from impurity and to bring forgiveness. Only once the rite of atonement had been made with blood on the altar could the priest then safely enter the holy place, and they could meet with God there, and the people could meet with God. So the presupposition for safe meeting with God was their cleansing from impurity and sin. Once that had happened, they were clean in God's eyes. And then the priest on duty washed his hands and feet and entered the holy place and attended to the lamps morning and evening. But the most important thing he did was to bring fire from the altar and incense, and to burn it on the incense altar in front of the Holy of Holies. As he did that, he had the names of the 12 tribes of Israel on his breastplate. He, as it were, brought the people into God's presence in an act of intercession. And then after he'd placed the coals and incense, the most holy incense, on the altar in front of God's throne, which is the holy in the Holy of Holies, the Ark of the Covenant and the Mercy Seat, then the priest came out of the holy place, if you like, bringing the sweetness of God's grace with him. The act of intercession on behalf of the people obtained God's gracious acceptance of them. And then the fourth act was the presentation of the burnt offering. If you can imagine, the priest, first of all, placing the various parts of the lamb all over the altar, the coals on the altar. It's a bit like a barbecue. You know, there's old red-hot coals there, and the priest places, covers the whole surface of the altar with the parts of the lamb. And then he gets some of the flour mixed with olive oil and incense and throws it over the altar. Now, if you know if you put flour on coals, all it produces is black smoke and a stink. But because the flour was mixed with olive oil, and very fine olive oil, it burnt up very quickly and produced a cloud of sweet-smelling smoke from the altar. And that cloud signaled God's acceptance and God's presence in grace with his people. The people could come there to pray to God. And then the fifth part of the daily burnt offering was the performance of the Aaronic benediction by the priest on duty in front of the altar. You know it well, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord look on you with favor and give you peace. So the holy name of God was placed on the people who'd assembled in front of the altar, and the blessing of God was transmitted from God to the people. If you like, the priest went in representing the people and bringing their needs to God, and he came out from God's presence to the altar and then from the altar to bring God's blessing to his people. That's the purpose of the divine service, is for God to bring his blessing to his people. And then the ritual for the daily burnt offering ends with the priests taking the leftover flour mixed with olive oil and baking bread from it. Now, since the flour, part of the flour had been burnt on the altar, the rest of the flour was most holy. And they ate the most holy bread as God's gifts, the bread from his table in the holy place. For the priests on duty, the daily service culminated in a holy meal. A holy meal with most holy bread that by which God shared his holiness with his people. Just one thing about the daily burnt offering, the daily order of service. At its heart, you have the what looks like a ordinary meal in the ancient world. You have bread, you have olive oil, you have meat, and you have wine. But it looks as if this meal is being offered to God, but in fact it's turned around. God takes these things and makes them holy and spreads a meal, a holy meal, a meal of blessing for his people, for the priests.
That's a bit complicated.
Do you want to pick up anything there?
Yeah, we'll on the other side of the break, we'll pick up there. I think it's a great outline to consider how it is that here in Leviticus, we have God specifying these things all so that he might deliver to his people the cleansing, the sacrifice, the atonement for sin by the shedding of blood. When we come back, some might say, well, this is all very elaborate. That's typical of the Old Testament. The people were being taught an object lesson. Did they actually receive the forgiveness that these things pointed toward? The book of Leviticus is our study with Dr. John Kleinig. It's Issues Etc. 24. We're in hour 15 of Issues Etc. 24, and we'll have about another 90 minutes on Leviticus. Your questions and your comments are welcome. 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-MYIE or talk back at issuesetc.org. More Issues Etc. 24 with Leviticus after this.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. And I say it's all right.
The cross is always relevant. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Scott in Oakwood, Illinois, with a few thoughts on what Issues Etc. means to me. I was first exposed to Issues Etc. because of Spirituality of the Cross by Jean Edward Veith. I couldn't put the book down and eventually gave my copy to a Roman Catholic friend. And in the process of replacing it at cph.org, I bought a 3-CD set of Issues Etc. interviews with her. I found the show again while putting in extra hours at school and streaming Issues Etc. from a certain Lutheran radio station of ill repute. I used to stop at Panera on my 42-mile commute home to download the podcast because I had no home internet access. I went out of my way to access Issues Etc. on demand because it was intelligently done Christian radio that had Jesus' death and resurrection at the forefront of its theology, unlike my local family-friendly Fatal to Your Health FM radio station. Issues Etc. is ongoing catechesis for both me and my wife and helped us get through a tough period in our church when we weren't hearing Jesus Christ and Him crucified in the sermons. We both enjoy listening to the program, especially on Fridays with Soundbite of the Week. What Issues Etc. means to me is a far smaller matter than what it means to Christianity at large. It brings together a community of like-minded confessional Lutherans from across denominational lines, alleviating the stress of, am I the only one? It proclaims the work Christ has done on our behalf and sounds the alarm when false teaching enters our midst. LCMS Inc. lost a great asset when firing you guys, but it only makes Issues Etc. better because it is able to openly criticize false teachings arising from anywhere. Please continue to bring this Christ-centered, cross-focused message to the world for many years to come. From the bottom of an on-demand listener's heart, I thank you.
And thank you, Scott, in Oakwood, Illinois, and for all those of you listening live or on demand to Issues Etc. 24. We got great news from Matt in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He reports that Concordia Theological Seminary there in Fort Wayne, they're streaming Issues Etc. 24 in the Student Commons all day today. Doesn't get any better than that.
And thanks to Marilyn Graham. She's the newest member of the Reformation Club. Marilyn's in Wheaton, Illinois. Thank you very much, Marilyn. And let's also say thank you to some current members of the Reformation Club, Jerry and Betty Alm in Grangeville, Idaho, Robert Kiefer in Auburn, Indiana, and Matthew and Shannon Kite in Baldwin, Missouri. Thanks for supporting Issues, etc.
Did I hear you sucking on a cough drop?
No, you know what? I have to have my throat's scratchy, so I have to have something to take a bit of the scratchy away. And yeah, I'm cheating. It's a piece of gum. So I need some help here. I mean, about 16 hours in, and I don't think out of all the years that I've been behind a microphone in one way or another that my voice has sounded this poor after being on the air for a while. You know,
it's just being up. That's all it is. I mean, I don't think it's a matter of talking too much. Did you guys see me running by? Oh, you have the blinds closed. You didn't see me running by the window?
During the break, I just took a couple laps, too.
I am just completely embarrassing you guys out there. I mean, the people who are just showing up for work, which is, it's still early for people to show up for work, but there are enough Collinsvilleites or whatever they call themselves out there wondering what this middle-aged guy is doing out there running around the parking lot. But I've fallen asleep sitting down, lying down. Occasionally behind the wheel, but never almost falling asleep while standing up. So, got to get the blood going, get it all working. You guys are like made out of what? Iron. I mean, neither of you, especially Craig, he's literally planted himself there and stays completely wide awake the entire time. I'm in here moving around, trying to stay, keep the blood going. Craig, it's all pure mental concentration with him.
It's hard to look this awake, let me tell you.
Hey, Tim in Canada on our Facebook.com/issuesETC page writes, "Hello, son. Still sounding good. Thanks for listening up there in Canada. And again, during Issues Etc. 24, we're asking you to help support the Christ-centered cross-focus outreach of Issues Etc. by joining our monthly or annual giving program, the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. You can call now. Craig and I are standing by, patiently waiting to take your pledge at 877-623-6943, 877-623-MY-IE, or You can donate online, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org.
Don't forget, Jeff, in just about 90 minutes, we'll draw once again for another bundle package and another copy, signed copy of Pastor Matt Harrison's book, The Little Book of Joy. So that's coming up in another hour and a half. You can give us a call and tell us you want to be part of the Reformation Club, 877-623-MY-IE, 877-623-6943, or you can make a secure online donation at our website, issuesetc.org.
Dr. John Kleinig is our guest. We're looking at the book of Leviticus, another 90 minutes with him, Issues, Etc., 24. I would say we're in the home stretch. About 4 hours, no, not four, 8 hours to go after we conclude the book of Leviticus. This is key to understanding. We don't leave the book of Leviticus behind, except for those commands that pertain to the moral law, because there's much to be learned, Old Testament and New Testament, about the nature of true Christian worship, as we've already seen here. So the divine service has this form to it. And I guess one thing was unclear. Is this a daily thing for the people of God during the time of tabernacle worship, Dr. Kleinig?
Yes, it's twice every day, the morning and the evening. So it coincides with the morning and evening meal, roughly speaking. So it's twice every day. Not quite in our timing, but say 9 o'clock in the morning and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So the same offerings were presented morning and evening, and in between them, the people brought their own offerings. The divine service was done by the priests on behalf of the whole nation. It was the national service. And then the people could come midday, bringing their own offerings and prayers to God.
Brett in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania asks via email, why does God go into such depth on the rules concerning the sacrificial offerings for concerning Moses? And he thanks us for the program. Why does he go into such depth?
I don't know. Most of those why questions can't be answered except very tentatively and speculatively. I know that each one of them has its reason, but it seems to me that God had a very difficult task to do in establishing the divine service, just as he has a very difficult task to do with us, because people bring their own baggage, if you like, into church. It's not as if the people in the ancient world didn't have various forms of worship. They had thousands of different rituals and different forms of worship. And so God has to protect, if you like, his holiness and protect the delivery of his grace, his mercy, his blessing to his people from all the various pagan forms of distortion. If I can just take one example out of many possible examples, everywhere in the ancient world, people were interested in the supernatural realm, and it was the spirits of the dead who gave them access to the supernatural world, and it was held that they brought supernatural blessing to them. One of the regulations that God gave, both to the people and the priests, was that the priests had to avoid any contact with anybody who was dead, likewise the people. And if they had contact with a dead person, they were unclean and had to have ritual cleansing. In this way, the Old Testament laws, if you like, cut the connections with animistic paganism. Now, I could illustrate, give many other illustrations like that, but there's two kinds of laws. One has to do with the elaborate divine service, the positive side of it, and then there's the negative side, guarding against the falsification and the manipulation of God by means of worship. One of the things that we need to realize that worship is not one-dimensional. Either in the Old Testament or New Testament, God doesn't give us one blessing, but he gives us grace upon grace, blessing upon blessing. And we quite often reduce God's gifts, God's many gifts, to a single gift. So if I can just go back and illustrate from the daily service, you remember the order begins with the rite of atonement. Then you have the burning of incense in the holy place. Then you get the presentation of the burnt offerings on the altar, the column of smoke by which God made himself available, accessible to his people in a gracious way, and then culminating in the performance of benediction. Okay, that's the basic pattern. Now, each of those parts, in each of those parts, God is at work. First of all, God forgives his people and cleanses them from sin so that they can come into his presence without defiling and desecrating his holiness. They have safe access to God. Just as for us, our divine service begins with confession and absolution so that we can approach God and come to Holy Communion with a clear conscience. And then you have the burning of incense by which the priest on duty secured God's acceptance of his people and the assurance, if you like, of God's favour. Then, thirdly, you had the burnt offering itself, by means of which God met with his people, gave them access to his grace, and made them holy. And then all of that culminates in God giving his blessing. But if you ever look at the Aaronic benediction, it's not just one blessing. There's the Lord bless you and keep you, so there's protection from evil powers. God bless you and keep you, make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. God be favorably disposed to you. God lift up his face or countenance upon you and give you peace. So there's many different details because God delivers so many gifts to his people in and through the divine service. We could talk about something similar in the New Testament, but things change there because the focus is on Christ and his presence with us rather than on this elaborate ritual.
Talk, if you would, about the necessity for what you call ritual purity in order for people to both administer, that would be the priests and the Levites themselves, these two classes of servants in the divine service, and then also the concept of ritual purity with regard to the people's participation in the divine service.
Yes. It's a dangerous thing for a holy God to meet with his people, because the people are unclean and unholy and sinful. Now, if you bring a holy God into the presence of a holy of an unholy, sinful people, then you have a recipe for disaster. God's holiness coming into contact with what's unclean, unholy, incompatible with it, destroys it. If somebody or something unclean, and something unclean is that which is incompatible with God and his holiness. If something that's incompatible with God's holiness comes into the presence of God, then that desecrates God's holiness, and God reacts with the fire of his wrath to destroy that which is unclean. Now, it's not a problem if it's a thing, but if it's a person, the unclean person is destroyed. So before somebody or something comes into God's presence and can receive God's holiness, can be sanctified, that person or that thing needs to be cleansed from impurity. The closer you come to God in the Old Testament, the more you receive his holiness. The closer you come to God, the greater the demands for purity, ritual purity, liturgical purity, if you like. There's a minimal requirements for purity for people who don't come to the tabernacle, who just live out in the camp. But if an Israelite comes into the courtyard and approaches God, then they need to be cleansed from certain forms of physical impurity. The Levites who come closer to God have more stringent demands for purity. And the high priest, who shares most fully in God's holiness, has the greatest requirements for ritual purity, to make sure that he doesn't desecrate God's holiness, because if God's holiness is desecrated, then people will experience God's wrath rather than his grace in the divine service.
People hear this and they are perhaps are saying this, it sounds so primitive. It sounds almost like a pagan idea. How is it different from the notions that the pagans had, who also had their temples, if you will? They also had their rituals and sacrifices whereby they believed they were appeasing the wrath of their gods or currying the favor of their gods. How is this Old Testament thing given to God's people in Leviticus different from that?
There is some overlap. There's some connection. And this is because every human being on earth has a sense that they are not the way they should be. And that's a very basic, instinctive thing. And it's quite a physical thing. If I can just illustrate, say, for example, every morning I have a shower and I brush my teeth. If I don't shower and brush my teeth, then I feel unclean, unpresentable. It's something that's very, very instinctive. People who study various societies would say that this distinction between clean and unclean is as close to a universal cultural pattern that you could get. Now, it's only in the Old Testament that this sense of impurity, which is innate in each of us, is connected with God's holiness. Pagan societies, you usually divide people into two groups of people. There are those who are clean, that's usually my group, and then there's those who are unclean. But for the Old Testament, all human beings are more or less unclean in God's sight, and all purity and all holiness comes from God. Just to go back to the original question, that sense of impurity, which many people, and I've heard this again and again from friends and colleagues and people that I meet, who say it's very, very primitive, is in fact fundamental to us. I don't know whether any of you have heard people say, oh, I couldn't come to church. Why? Because the roof would fall in. That's the basic feeling of every human being, that if you come into the presence of any God, but if you come into the presence of the living God, God's presence exposes that which is incompatible with him, impurity. And one experiences that not just mentally and emotionally, but also physically, in the sense of being unclean. The demand for, the requirement for purity is even more stringent in the New Testament. than the Old Testament, as you may remember. Whereas it was sufficient to have physical purity in the Old Testament, what Jesus demands is purity of heart, complete, total purity. And the book of Hebrews says that the blood of Jesus cleanses our consciences so that from dead works so that we can serve the living God. I reckon that instead of this being very primitive and incomprehensible to modern people, I think that most modern people, particularly young people, have an acute sense of impurity. This is evident in so many different ways. People have pointed out, for example, that the ecological movement got nowhere until people identified ecological disorder with impurities. Now, it has nothing to do with impurity, but as soon as you label it as impurity, then it sells itself. I think that one of the secrets of evangelizing, if I can put it that way, people not just in Africa and in New Guinea and in Asia and in Muslim countries, but also to re-evangelize young people in the West. One of the best ways in which we can present the Christian faith to them is in terms of cleansing from impurity. Because most young people, I find, have an acute sense that they live in a contaminated world and that they are somehow contaminated. And this contamination diminishes them and robs them of life and blessing and many good things. As I said, you can see it most clearly in the appeal of the ecological movement, which sells its message by identifying ecological disorder in terms of environmental impurity.
Dan,
now that's a long answer for a very short question, but I wanted to spend some time with it because I think there's much more here that we can explore and that is very, very useful for us. If I can give an illustration, one of my best friends, when he heard that I was doing a commentary on Leviticus, immediately got stuck into me about this stupid stuff about ritual impurity. And, you know, the kind of thing that clean and unclean animals and a woman who menstruates is unclean and a man who has ejaculation of semen at night becomes unclean and all this kind of stuff. And he says, this is about as stupid as you could get. And I very politely tried to explain it to him. And this came resulted in a very lengthy discussion. And then he himself confessed that admitted that on the one hand, he had this acute sense of which in which he had to have clean clothes every day, a clean shirt and washing. And that for when his wife had their first baby, he felt that he couldn't touch her. And he couldn't work out why this was the case. So, you know, this sense of impurity, I think, is far more common than we allow. We don't talk very much about it, and we don't have, if you like, a code to discuss it the way the Old Testament and maybe Jews and Mohammedans, Muslims, do.
Dan in Columbus. Yes, go ahead.
Sorry. Keep going.
Well, Dan in Columbus, Ohio, has this question. He says, it's interesting to read Leviticus and its rites in light of Hebrews 9 and 10. In these sacrifices, there is a reminder of sins, he says. If we didn't have the shedding of blood, we might lose sight of the real consequence of sins, that there are more than just temporal consequences. Your thoughts there with about 2 minutes before we take a break.
Yes. The sacrifices don't just remind us of sins. The law does that. God's law exposes sins and reminds us of sin. I'd rather put it positively. That it's not just that they the sacrifices show us the consequence of sin, which is death, but that the blood which comes from the sacrificed animal becomes then the means by which we receive purification, cleansing, justification. And that's because God chooses to use, the blood of the animal and then the blood of his son to cleanse us and to make us pure and holy in his eyes. So I don't think it's just a reminder of sin or even the consequences of sin. It is that. But it has a very strong positive function. In fact, if you like, our whole redemption, our cleansing, our sanctification, all God's gifts are given, delivered to us through the blood of his son.
Well, when we come back, we're going to talk more about the book of Leviticus. We're done with hour one on Leviticus with Dr. John Kleinig and ready for hour two of the same book, Issues, Etc. 24, continuous live Bible study. The sun is up, and we're starting the morning portion heading into the afternoon portion of Issues, Etc. 24, well past the halfway point. I invite your questions or your comments as we talk about, well, essentially, Christian worship with the book of Leviticus and Dr. John Kleinig of Australian Lutheran College and author of the Concordia Commentary on Leviticus. Our call-in number is 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Email us here in the studio with questions or comments, anything on the book of Leviticus, talkback at issuesetc.org, talkback at issuesetc.org, or you can Twitter us at issuesetc. And as so many have been, you can leave questions or comments for us at our Issues Etc. Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. 24.
Faithful confession trumps company loyalty. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Greetings, brothers. What does Issues Etc. mean to me? Well, being a pastor in Canada, we are not given the same opportunities usually to attend many of the seminars and conferences that are held in the United States. And I know for myself and several other pastors, Issues Etc. proves to be a great source of continuing education. The program keeps us engaged in thinking theologically and also with the latest issues that arise in our society and the church. And I can say I have learned much from Issues Etc. in the 8 years I have served in the parish since graduating from the seminary. And for this, I am most grateful. And also, I just wanted to note that since the rebirth of Issues Etc., I have noticed a distinct improvement in your thrill music, at least I think that's what it is called in the radio biz. The music is always matched thematically to the topic under discussion, but also is often just plain old good music. I have often wondered how you come up with all the music you do that matches so well to the topics under discussion. Well done. Thanks a lot. This is Pastor Mike Keith from Our Savior Lutheran Church in Fort Qu'Appelle, Saskatchewan, Canada. God's blessings upon your continued work at Issues Etc.
Yes, it truly is a worldwide outreach, and we love our neighbors to the north up in Canada, especially those who are listening to Issues Etc. 24 live or on demand via podcast. We love our on-demand listeners. And we've got lots of people listening here in the States as well. Here's an email we just received from Brian in Utah. He says, well, this morning I tore myself from sleep to make sure I could hear the Leviticus study by Dr. Kleining live. Bless you guys for this 24-hour study. I also really enjoyed Pastor Brian Wolfmiller's Book of Job study, a personal favorite. What a wonderful way to give added opportunity for us on-demand listeners to listen live for once, to think deeply about the Word of God, and, of course, to support our favorite podcast. Thank you for being a constant Christ-centered, cross-focused lifeline to the Word of God. It has meant a great deal to me, both as a pastor and as a Lutheran family man here in the theological and cultural wilds of Salt Lake City. Christ's blessings be with the staff at Issues, etc., and all your listeners. Thanks so much for listening in Utah, Brian, and thanks for becoming part of the Issues, etc. Reformation Club. And that's part of what we're doing here during Issues, etc. 24, is encouraging, inviting you to join our monthly or annual giving program, the Issues, etc. Reformation Club. Four levels of giving, anywhere from us, you can join for as low as $25 a month, or a one-time annual gift of $250. That's the confessor level. You can pledge your support right now, 877-623-6943. It's 7 o'clock in the morning, Central Time here in the Midwest, 877-623-MYIE, or make a donation online, issuesetc.org.
Jeff, as you said earlier, operators are standing by. I feel like we're getting into a swing here, don't you? Into the swing of things. And, you know, we started out, first couple of breaks were a bit rough, but we're in the swing of it now. I think we're getting the hang of it. So let's thank folks who previously joined the Reformation Club. Let's say thank you to Mark Young in Cedar Park, Texas. Thanks to Mr. and Mrs. Rick and Karen Durham from Monroe, Michigan. And thank you to Mrs. Deborah Sill Springer from Wichita, Kansas. Thank you for supporting Christ-centered, cross-focused talk radio, Issues, etc.
And every 2 hours, so an hour from now, we always have a drawing, and everybody who joins the Issues, etc. Reformation Club during Issues, etc. 24 is put into that drawing, and we draw for an autographed copy of Pastor Matt Harrison's new book, A Little Book on Joy, an autographed copy of that book. And also you receive an LPR bundle package, the much coveted LPR bundle package that we only give away to people who visit our studio or who win Soundbite of the Week, Issues, Etc. Soundbite of the Week on Fridays. That's an I Have Issues t-shirt, an Issues, Etc. travel mug, pen, and bumper sticker. So please join the Issues, Etc. Reformation Club during Issues, Etc. 24, issuesetc.org. Or 1-877-623-6943.
Jeff, you know, I don't know how you feel about it. I think you feel the same way I do. And that is that the Reformation Club, for us and our listeners, is a win-win. And it helps us so we can budget our expenses more efficiently. Kind of helps us, you know, get an idea month to month. We know what's coming in, or we know you know, where we need to be by the end of the month for our budgeting, because as everyone knows, we do rely upon you, our listener, for all the costs that bring you this radio outreach. So we depend upon you for every dollar, from every dollar from paying for airtime to salaries to supplies. So it's a vital part of our budgeting here at Issues, etc. And it's also for you, it's a win. You know, besides the satisfaction of bringing Issues, etc. to yourself and others around the world, you know, you get a few perks. So t-shirts, books, things of that nature. So it's a win-win in that way. And give us a call and let us know that you're interested in the Reformation Club. Telephone numbers, 877-623-MYIE. 877-623-6943, or you can make a secure online donation at our website, www.issuesetc.org.
Issues, etc. 24, hour 16, starts now.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc., starting the second hour of the Book of Leviticus with Dr. John Kleining. Let's see, we've talked about holiness, ritual purity, and the sacrifices and offerings that were required of the twice daily divine service for the Old Testament people of God. We have yet to talk about those who carried out these sacrifices and these offerings, namely the Levites and the priests, in any great detail. And something that I think we need to stress here as we go into the rest of that conversation. Dr. Kleinig, you talked earlier about holiness, and I think in the pagan religions, if I'm not wrong, it was about cultivating a personal holiness or a personal reason in oneself to please the gods, whereas it sounds like everything in the Levitical form of worship, that Old Testament divine service, was designed for God to come to his people in a way that they were not destroyed by his wrath, and for the people, through these sacrifices and offerings, to actually participate in God's holiness, not to cultivate a holiness of their own. Am I saying too much there about the Levitical form of the divine service?
No, you're spot on. The emphasis in Leviticus is that God is the only source of holiness. Pagan people believed that there were many... Now, holiness was everywhere. Now, there were many different sources of holiness, and you could, if you like, produce or manufacture your own holiness. Now, again and again, or five times in Leviticus, God says, I, the Lord your God, am holy. And this is exclusive, if you like. It's, I am holy, and nobody and nothing else is holy apart from me. God is holy, and he's the giver of holiness. And that's where the accent lies in Leviticus, is God as the giver of holiness, the source of holiness, the one who shares his holiness with his people. Seven times in Leviticus chapter 20, 21, 22, God says, I am the Lord who sanctifies you, or sanctifies them, or to sanctifies it. So scholars call this the formula of sanctification. It's a participle. He says, I am Yahweh, the Lord, the sanctifying, the one who sanctifies you. It's an ongoing activity, and he sanctifies his people, he sanctifies the priests, he sanctifies the tabernacle, he sanctifies the food that's part of the daily offerings. If you like to look at it one way, the people bring ordinary common food to God. God takes that food and makes it holy and gives it back to them, so that instead of that food just communicating or nourishing them physically, that food becomes the means by which he communicates, shares his holiness with them. And together with his holiness, everything else that belongs to his holiness, life and blessing and protection. Yes, so the accent, if you like, in Leviticus, is on the reception of God's holiness and the delivery of it from God to his people through the, you know, what we would call the means of grace, the means by which God delivers things to us. And that's what he institutes through his word, the word which sanctifies everything, the word which institutes the means by which God shares his holiness with his people.
Are these Old Testament sacraments?
Yes. The offerings, if you like, the daily burnt offering, is the Old Testament sacrament. It's a holy meal. This culminates then in the great New Testament sacrament. You have ritual washings in the Old Testament, which leads into baptism, and you have the sacrificial meal, the sacrificial banquet of the Old Testament, which leads then to the great sacrament of the altar in the New Testament. Now, something remarkable happens when we go from Old Testament, New Testament. You may remember that the priests on duty were the only ones who were allowed to eat the most holy bread from the offerings. They did that every day while they were on service. And by means of that bread, God shared his holiness, communicated his holiness with them. They could also eat the most holy meat from the sin offering and the guilt offering. But they never, ever drank any blood. Now, one of the most stringent prohibitions in the Old Testament is the prohibition against the drinking of blood and drinking of the blood of the offerings. Pagan people used to do that to get the life power of animals, supernatural life power, but God forbade that. The New Covenant and the sacrificial banquet which Jesus institutes, the sacrament of the altar, Jesus doesn't just say, take and eat, this is my body which is given for you. But most remarkably, he says, take and drink, this is the blood of the new covenant which is shed for you for the forgiveness of sins. So the blood by which he atones for sins, the blood by which he cleanses us, also is given to us to drink as the means by which he makes and keeps us holy. Yes, so the sacrificial meals or the daily sacrifices are the sacrament of the Old Testament.
David in Wilson, Texas, emails us. He asks, do you think much of the Roman Catholic theology on the sacrifice of the Mass comes from Leviticus? It seems like it would. Which part do they understand incorrectly the most? That is, the Roman Catholic understanding of the sacrifice of the Mass. Your thoughts there, Dr. Kleinig?
Yeah, it's fairly hard to generalize about Catholic theology at the moment. There's so many different strands and emphases, Catholic theology now is not exactly the same as the theology at the time of Reformation. But yes, it's true that a lot of the theology of classical Catholic theology comes from Leviticus and the Old Testament. Now, as to which part of it they misunderstand, or I'd rather say they put the emphasis in the wrong place in classical Catholic theology. As you know, classical theology emphasizes that in the Mass, the priest offers the body and blood of Christ as an unbloody sacrifice for the living and the dead to God the Father. So the emphasis in classical Catholic theology is on Holy Communion as our offering of Christ's body and blood to God the Father. As you know, the Lutheran emphasis, which agrees with the Book of Leviticus, is that in the sacrament we receive the body and blood of Christ, which he offered for us on the cross, and he now gives to us, and by means of which he delivers all the benefits that he won for us in his sacrificial death. So that's, if you like, the difference in emphasis in classical Catholic understanding of Leviticus and the way I think Leviticus should be understood. The second Catholic emphasis is that we are sanctified by obedience, by what we do. We're made holy by obedience rather than by the reception of the holy things which make and keep us holy. So, to put it quite simply, the Catholic emphasis is on our service of God. And by the way, that's not just a Catholic emphasis. That's, if you like, the normal Protestant emphasis in their theology of worship and Holy Communion. We serve God. The emphasis in Leviticus is that in the daily sacrifice, God met with his people and he served them. There's a strange formula which we find repeated again and again in connection with the divine service. You'll find it in Exodus chapter 29, where God institutes the daily sacrifice. He says, amongst other things, you know, I will meet with the people of Israel, and it, that's Israel, will be sanctified by my glory. I will consecrate the tent of meeting, the altar. Aaron also and his sons I will consecrate to serve me as priests. I will dwell among the people and will be their God. It's in the daily sacrifice that God becomes God to his people. He serves them as God. He acts as God on behalf of his people. That's the emphasis in Leviticus, that God comes to meet with his people so that he can act as God, serve them as God, be their God, do the things that a God should do for his people.
Brian in Salt Lake City, Utah, emails us, as a husband and father, I'm curious if you could paint a mental picture of what the average family's participation in the Levitical divine service would be and how it's different or similar to parents and children's participation today in the divine service. What was it like for the people of the Levitical times to participate in this?
Is that Brian Fatmiller? No. A very, very good question indeed. It would be totally different. Now, to get a sense of this, you need to imagine a situation where people didn't eat meat regularly the way we do. So they would eat meat maybe 2-3 times a year. The average family only went to the tabernacle and the temple and participated in the divine service 2 or 3 times a year. This was at the pilgrim festivals. So Passover, Pentecost, and tabernacles. Pentecost was optional, but normally speaking, if they could, the representatives of every family, that's the men, grown women, and children who are old enough to make the journey, would go from their homes, wherever they were, and go up to the tabernacle and then later on to Jerusalem for the Feast of Passover and for the Feast of Tabernacles. You get a picture of it in the Gospels, Jesus and his family going to Jerusalem. Now, as part of that, they would bring their annual offerings to God. And for them, you could say that they would come to the tabernacle and temple, and their involvement in the divine service would focus around two things in practical terms. They would go to the service in order to receive God's blessing. The only time they'd hear the Aaronic benediction, Yahweh bless you and keep you, Yahweh make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you, Yahweh look on you with favor and grant you peace, is at these pilgrim festivals. They would receive God's blessing. And the whole of their involvement in worship would culminate in a feast, the sacrificial banquet. They would present their first-born animals and their first fruits of the produce. The flour would be made into bread. The meat would be roasted. The wine, which had been consecrated, then would be drunk. And so they would eat and drink and rejoice in God's presence. So for the average family, the focus of their participation in the divine service was a journey from home to the holy place, a pilgrimage, the reception of blessing from God, They would also make their prayers to God if they had particular petitions to make as part of that in connection with their offerings. But the best part of it was the sacrificial banquet. And they would, for those 2 weeks of the year, live like royalty. They would eat meat every day. And they'd drink wine and eat the best of food. The picture that's used in the Old Testament is of God as king and his people coming to him in order to have an audience with him and as his guests, eating the food that comes from his table, the holy food that comes from his table.
One contrast there. I think you mentioned that the only time they would personally hear that Aaronic benediction that is so common in historic Christian worship today and in the past is just those one or two or three times that they would appear there for the pilgrim festivals. Christians, if they attend a church where the historic liturgy is observed, where historic forms of Christian worship are observed, will likely hear that benediction every Lord's Day.
Yes. And what the people had occasionally, we have regularly every week. We go on pilgrimage and we have a holy feast and we receive that wonderful blessing. It's interesting that Aaronic benediction is the only liturgical text that's divinely instituted in the Old Testament. If you like, it's like the Lord's Prayer or the words of institution. God institutes lots of things which enact his word in the divine service, but this is the only text that he gives them. So it's very, very special. And for the Israelites, particularly in that post-exilic period, the only time that they would hear the name of God, Yahweh, would be when the Aaronic benediction was pronounced over them and God's blessing was given to them in their participation in the divine service, two times a year at the great pilgrim festivals. By the way, those pilgrim festivals were called meeting times, the times in which the Israelites met with God at the altar, first at the tabernacle and then at the temple.
Is there I'd seen, and this applies probably more to the people of God during their sojourn in the wilderness where the tabernacle is first constructed by Moses and the other Levites and priests. But as they traveled in the wilderness, it was described to me as kind of like a bullseye. At the center of the camp is the tabernacle with the holy place and the holy of holies, kind of the epicenter of God's presence and of holiness. And then as you moved out geographically from the center, it wasn't so much that things became less holy, but perhaps less participation in that central holiness, and that everything outside the camp was considered to be profane. Is this an accurate picture of how it was kind of laid out for them?
Absolutely. And not just for the wilderness. You had, if you had like concentric circles, the center circle was the Holy of Holies. And then you had the holy place. Then you had the courtyard around that. And then you had the priests who encamped around the courtyard of the tabernacle, and then you had the 12 tribes of Israel around that. So you had concentric circles of holiness. So God's one of the purposes of the divine service, according to Exodus Leviticus, is so that God can dwell in the midst of his people. So that, if you like, they don't have to go up to heaven to meet with him because he is right there with them. He's traveling with them on their journey to the promised land. But the same thing applies once they come into the land. And you see this very, very clearly developed in rabbinical theology. You get sort of circles of holiness. The most holy place is the Holy of Holies. Then you get the holy place. Then you get the courtyard of the temple, the inner court. Then you get the outer court. Then you get the city of Jerusalem, which is holy city. And then around that, you get the holy land of Israel. And outside of Israel, you have unclean space, unclean territory. Yeah. So you get those concentric circles.
Would the, I mean, just so we're clear on how this took place, permitted within the courtyard, actually within the physical boundary of the synagogue as it was initially constructed, only the priests and the Levites, would the average Israelite ever see with his own eyes what was going on inside that courtyard where there stood the great basin and the altar of sacrifice? And all those things. And then, of course, the holy place and the Holy of Holies. Would they have ever laid eyes on that?
Depends on what. Are you talking about the tabernacle now or the temple?
The tabernacle in this case.
The tabernacle, okay. Now, the tabernacle was two cubic squares, if you like, at the center of facing towards the east. The entrance was on the east side, if you can imagine that. It only had one entrance. And then you had two cube-shaped squares. The center of the cube that was closest to the entrance, there was the altar for burnt offering. And then at the center of the other cube was the Holy of Holies. Between the altar for burnt offering and the holy place was the laver for the washing of the priests. Now, the ordinary Israelites could come up as far as the altar. Okay? They could came in the entrance in the east, and they could go up to the altar, but they couldn't go on to the altar. Only the priest on duty could do that. The Levites could go anywhere in that courtyard. Only the priest on duty for the day could enter the holy place, and only the high priest could enter the Holy of Holies once a year on the Day of Atonement. So you get that gradation of holiness again. But the people could come, provided there were not too many of them, they could see the first and last part of the daily divine service. And you get a little bit of this in the beginning of Luke's Gospel applying to the temple. They would see the splashing of the blood against the side of the altar for the rite of atonement. They would see the priest washing his hands and feet before he entered the holy place. But they wouldn't see all that was done in the holy place. Then they would also see very, very clearly the present, the burning up of the offerings by the priest on the altar. That was in public view. And lastly, the priest would stand in front of the altar to deliver the benediction. They would see that. So if you think in terms of those four main parts, the rite of atonement with the splashing of blood, the burning of incense, the burning of up of the burnt offering, the smoking up of the burnt offerings, and the performance of the benediction, they would see three of those four parts of the divine service.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more with Dr. John Kleining about the book of Leviticus. In fact, for another 25 minutes, it's issues, etc., 24. 25 more minutes in the book of Leviticus, and then where will we be? We'll move on to Dr. Tim Seleska and the book of Psalms, which is actually a bunch of little books. It's issues, etc., 24. Stay tuned.
You canceled the wrong show. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. is the most stimulating talk show I'm aware of on the internet. after a 15-year absence from the church. I credit Issues Etc. as the single most important reason for my return to Christianity in general and the church in particular. It is an invaluable resource, and I constantly refer my friends and family to various broadcasts, which include some of the best theologians and thinkers of the modern age. I thank Pastor Todd Wilkin and his producer Jeff Schwartz from the bottom of my heart.
And thank you for listening, and thanks to all those who support this worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks for all the guests, by the way. Great guests. Conversation right now with Dr. Kleining on the Book of Leviticus. Super guests, and of course, the best host in Christian Talk Radio, Pastor Todd Wilkin. Jeff Schwartz, producer of Issues Etc., alongside Craig Feichtinger. It's 7:31 in the morning Central Time here in the Great Midwest and the epicenter of the universe, Collinsville, Illinois.
You better believe it. Collinsville is the epicenter. That's right.
I can't believe I said that. I can't stand Collinsville, Illinois, because I grew up in Edwardsville, Illinois, and I always say Edwardsville is the epicenter of the universe, but that tells you how tired I am.
You just can't stand us because we always beat you in high school basketball. So
yeah, that's not true, folks. Anybody listens closely, we won 19 straight games against the Collinsville Kayhawks.
Well, I meant when you were growing up. It was always
that's true.
Foregone conclusion that the Kayhawks would whip the Tigers. But, Jeff, let's thank some folks who are Reformation Club members. Daniel and Kristen Sanchez in Solon, Iowa. John and Roxanne Tagus in Baldwin, Illinois. Sumner and Sylvia Honeywell in Arnold, Missouri, and Kurt and Deborah Engelbrecht of Bel Air, Kansas. Thank you for supporting Issues Etc.
Now, what is the Reformation Club? The Issues Etc. Reformation Club. It's people who pledge to support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by becoming an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, patron. And they do so by pledging, and you can pledge right now, 877-623-6943, 877-623-MY-I-E, or online at issuesetc.org. And you can pledge to become a monthly or annual supporter of this worldwide outreach. And membership benefits include things like written transcripts, your church's contact information posted on our Find a Church page at our website, books of the month, and the I Have Issues t-shirts, as well as an autographed copy of Pastor Matt Harrison's book, Christ Have Mercy. So pledge your support now, please. And we're here to take your phone calls. 877-623-6943, 1-877-623-6943.
You know, we keep a drawer of testimonials just for occasions like this one. Here's an email, and he begins, I am one of your on-the-road listeners via iPod. I just heard your program on Buddhism while driving the 40 miles home from my church. I must say that I learned more from you and your guest about Buddhism than I learned in seminary and in the 35 years since. Kudos to you for your brilliant interviewing. Your work is educating clergy in ways you know not. Keep it coming. You are tools of the Holy Spirit, and we much appreciate you. Thanks, Wayne, in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin.
Here's a quick email from Jared in Wisconsin. Every time I listen to Issues Etc., I'm reminded how great our Lord is, that not so long ago Issues Etc. was thought to be gone and never to be heard again. Then, as quickly as it was taken from us, the Lord blessed us once again with sound radio programming full of the richness that is our Lutheran theology and joy. I marvel at his gifts he has bestowed upon his church, Catholic, and those at Issues Etc. with Christ alone is to be glorified for resurrecting. Thank you for being fishers of men. Thank you for listening, Jared in Wisconsin. 1-877-623-6943. Craig and I would love, matter of fact, you'd give us a little jolt if you pledge your support right now and join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. 877-623-MY-I-E. Speaking of jolt, I've been drinking this Tai Chi coffee. Is that what it's called, Wilkin? Tai Chi or Tai Chi tea or something?
I think so.
What did Mark Dowell from Columbia, Illinois call it?
Yeah, I think it was Tai Chi tea.
I thought it was chai tea.
Chai tea.
Yeah.
Hey, did you see this stuff, Wilkin? Look at this. It looks like it's coffee that's got a bunch of creamer in it. It's kind of almost a milky consistency.
I thought you'd just gone and done your typical thing. Is it good?
Yeah, it's I've never had before, and I like it. I was tired of coffee. I was tired of Mountain Dew and Dr. Pepper and water, and so
I think I'm to the point where the caffeine isn't making a dent anymore. I mean, I think my brain is my body's metabolized enough caffeine. It can't do anymore. So it's going to be 8.5 hours. So we're just going to, it's going to be adrenaline and listener support. That's what it'll be.
Laps around the parking lot.
Yes.
Hey, when you're outside, don't scare any old ladies going over to Nails Etc. next door, okay?
No, I promise. I slow my pace if they pull in the parking lot. But it's and the prayers of our listeners to keep us awake and mentally alert so that because if one of us falls asleep, it's going to be a cascade effect. I can guarantee you that. If Jeff falls asleep, then Craig will quickly fall asleep, and then there's nothing keeping me awake, and our poor guest will be languishing there on the line, which we hope will not happen. Issues, Etc. 24. We're going to make it through all 24 hours one way or the other.
You know what would keep us awake?
Phone
if
calls.
The phones were to ring, there you go.
1-877-623-6943. Give us a pick-me-upper right now and join the Issues, Etc. Reformation Club. 877-623-MYIE.
Welcome back. 1.5 hour left in our study of the book of Leviticus. Dr. John Kleinig of Australian Lutheran College is our guest, author of the Concordia Commentary on Leviticus. Any question or comment you might have on Leviticus is certainly welcome. 1-877-623-MYIE. Leave a question or comment at our Issues Etc. fan page. That's facebook.com/issuesetc. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. Or Twitter us at IssuesETC. Bob in Florida says this, Dr. Kleinig, does Leviticus 26:12, I will walk among you, according to the ESV, relate to God walking with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden and or the presence of Christ in the divine service? Your thoughts there, Dr. Kleinig.
Yes, thank you for raising that question because it connects with something that I wanted to touch on more broadly. The climax of the book of Leviticus comes with chapter 26, and it begins with God saying, if you walk in my statutes and observe my commandments and do them. And the statutes he's talking about are the statutes that have to do with keeping the Sabbath and reverencing the sanctuary, the holy place, and the divine service. So if you, God says, if you worship me as I have established, then there will be certain blessings. And there are four sets of blessings. The first blessing that comes from right worship of God is the blessing of abundant rainfall and good harvest, because Israel's basically an agricultural community once they enter the land. The second blessing, from verse 6 to 8, is the blessing of national security, peace, and victory over against enemies who invade the land. The third blessing is the growth of families, with more than enough food to feed them, because it's no blessing to have a large family if you don't have enough food to feed them. And then comes the passage that you refer to in the question. The fourth blessing stands out from these rather natural blessings. God says, if you worship me in the right way, if I'm paraphrasing in, then I will make my blessing among you, and my soul shall not abhor you. I will walk among you and will be your God, and you shall be my people. So the result of right worship of God is God's dwelling, tabernacling with his people. Then as a result of that, God walks among them. Now, the only other place where we have God walking among his people is in Genesis chapter 3. You remember in the Garden of Eden, God walked to and fro in the garden. So if you like, paradise is restored, or people, God once again is with his people. And he goes on to say, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people. Now, that was partially fulfilled in the Old Testament, in the divine service at the tabernacle and then at the temple, but it was completely fulfilled in the incarnation of our Lord. You remember that in John chapter 1, verse 14, St. John says, "The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory as of the one and only Son of God." Jesus is the new tabernacle, and God dwells with his people in and through Jesus. And the walking of Jesus with his people in the divine service fulfills this. So what was partially fulfilled in the Old Testament divine service is completely fulfilled in the New Testament. And in both of them, paradise is restored, because ultimately then the final fulfillment of God dwelling with his people is given to us in the book of Revelation, when heavenly Jerusalem comes down to earth, and the heaven and earth are brought together completely, and God then dwells with his people and walks among them.
Via email, Josh in St. Louis says, "I like to joke that when I become a pastor, I will assign obscure Levitical codes as confirmation verses, such as Leviticus 15:12, a clay pot that the man touches must be broken, and any wooden article is to be rinsed with water." Could you imagine some poor kid having that verse assigned to him? But seriously, are there any passages from Leviticus that could make for a good confirmation verse? Your thoughts there.
The one that I would choose is a verse that I haven't had a chance to have a look at yet, and that's chapter 19, verse 2, which is quoted in 1 Peter 1, verse 15. This is the way it goes. "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to all the congregation of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy.'" Unfortunately, the English translation here is an approximation of the Hebrew text, because the Hebrew text is really very, very rich. It combines three different things. So you can translate it in three different ways. First of all, God says, "You will be holy." Why? "Because I, the Lord your God, am holy." It's a promise. So it's God's promise that he will sanctify his people. And it's a wonderful promise that you could give to somebody at confirmation. You will be holy. Secondly, it could also be translated in English with the present tense as a statement of facts. Fact, "You are holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy." And that's so for every Christian. Every baptized Christian is holy in and through union with Christ, completely holy. But then thirdly, it's also a demand. "You shall be holy, because I, the Lord your God, am holy." So that would be my first choice. Notice that this is said of the whole congregation of Israel. For the whole congregation of Israel, God makes the promise that they will be holy. He states that they are holy. He declares holy. And then he requires of them that they be holy. And that demand for holiness is not that they make themselves holy, but that they preserve, maintain, retain their holiness, that they don't abandon, that they don't give up and lose their holiness. That's my first choice. My second choice would be a chapter later, Leviticus chapter 20, verse 8. I've touched on it already. "I am the Lord who sanctifies you. I am the Lord who makes you holy." Thirdly, I don't know whether this would be a good confirmation text, because it's demand, There's that very famous command which Jesus repeats, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But I think I would pick the first one, and I would couch it in the form of a promise. You will be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy.
This one comes from Nathan in Little Rock, Arkansas, via email. He says, I've heard recently of a movement among Christians to keep the Levitical laws, such as eating according to the dietary requirements and celebrating festivals, including the Sabbath on Saturday. Several of my friends are doing this, and when I mentioned that this seemed like they were setting up new laws, they said, well, do you believe that we should keep the Ten Commandments? I said, yes. To which they replied, well, why wouldn't you believe in keeping the rest of God's laws? How do I answer them, asks Nathan in Little Rock. I know it sounds funny, but I am not sure how to phrase it. Thanks for this great marathon show. Thanks for listening in Little Rock, Nathan, and thanks for your question, Dr. Kleinig.
There are three different kinds of laws in the Old Testament. The first one are the moral laws, if you like, the second table of the Ten Commandments. Then you have the civil laws, which apply to Israel as a theocracy ruled by God. The ones that we're talking about here are the ceremonial or ritual laws. We don't keep them directly because they apply only before the coming of Christ. One of the things that one needs to realize is how important Jesus' work is in this. Jesus doesn't come to abolish the law. He comes to fulfill the law, and he completely fulfills every aspect of the ceremonial ritual law in the Old Testament. We don't need to build a tabernacle because Jesus, his body, is our tabernacle. Jesus is the mercy seat. Jesus is our high priest, etc. The whole of the ritual law in the Old Testament is fulfilled and changed by Christ's fulfillment. You'd need to follow that through, but what those people are doing, if you like, is abandoning Christ and going back and acting as if Christ has not come. The best answer to them is, in fact, the book of Galatians, which focuses around one Old Testament law, which has to do with circumcision. Now, Paul says, okay, if you're a Jew, it's quite right to be, you know, you can still be circumcised. But a person who's a Gentile doesn't need to be circumcised and shouldn't need to be circumcised. He says this over against people who said that unless you're circumcised, you won't receive the blessing that God promised to Abraham. Paul says, no. The blessing that's promised to Abraham comes through faith in Jesus, not through circumcision. And by the way, circumcision is fulfilled in baptism. That's New Testament teaching. Baptism, which doesn't just put off the foreskin of the penis, but puts off the whole of the old self, the old Adam. So we won't make any sense of the Christian understanding of Leviticus unless we track each one of these parts of the divine service in the Old Testament through to the New Testament and its fulfillment by Jesus. If your questioner wants to follow this further, get hold of my commentary, because each section of the commentary ends with fulfillment by Christ.
Okay, let's see, a couple more email, and then I have a final question for you before we wrap up our study of the book of Leviticus. From Jake in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and it has to do kind of the flip side of the question you just answered. It says, my question is for your guest concerning the different laws in Leviticus. Why are laws like the prohibition against homosexuality in Leviticus 18:22 still binding on Christians today, but other laws like cleaning houses, purification after childbirth, are no longer binding on Christians? I think you answered that fairly well. He says, I've had this sort of question given to me when debating the question of homosexuality with friends before. I use the Leviticus text to help prove my point from the Old Testament that homosexuality is sinful. And then my friends call Christians hypocritical for picking and choosing which Old Testament laws we want to be valid or not for today. So make the case, in the particular case of homosexuality, Dr. Kleinig, that that law is not one either fulfilled or abrogated or in some other way rendered obsolete by the fulfillment of Christ of the Old Testament.
Yes, it's not abrogated, but in fact, it's repeated. One of the very important interpretive principles is is something repeated by and reinforced by Christ and his apostles. So, as far as homosexuality is concerned, Paul picks up and reaffirms that prohibition of homosexuality in Romans 1, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and 1 Timothy chapter 1. So it's repeated there. And 1 Timothy chapter 1 connects it with the Ten Commandments and sees it as part of the Sixth Commandment. So one of the principles that we observe is of interpretation is this particular law, and we're talking about moral law here now rather than ceremonial law, repeated by, reaffirmed by Christ and his apostles. So that's very, very clear in the New Testament. What's interesting, for example, is that Jesus, when you think in terms of the Ten Commandments, Jesus reaffirms every one of the Ten Commandments except the Third Commandment, which is rather unexpected, the commandment about the Sabbath, but that's a ceremonial commandment.
Wally in Pennsylvania, we speak of Christ having fulfilled the ceremonial law. But often today we hear of pastors and stewardship programs requiring Christians to tithe, citing Leviticus 27, also Numbers 18, Deuteronomy 12, to the church. Can you comment on the role of the tithe for Christians today?
The best discussion of Christian giving is in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and 9, where Paul emphasizes the new way of giving. Now, there's which is voluntary and in response to what Christ has done and given to us. As far as tithing is concerned, it's a very, very good practice. And I would recommend it very, very highly. But it cannot and it should not be made compulsory. What is required of us is that we bring God-pleasing offerings as part of our divine service. And it's interesting what the God-pleasing offerings are, according to the New Testament. The God-pleasing offerings are our confession of faith in Jesus, prayers, praises, the giving of offerings, gifts, and good works. They are the offerings, the sacrifices that God is pleased with. Oh, and I forgot one. Paul says that we are to present our body with all its members as a God-pleasing sacrifice. So what are the God-pleasing sacrifices for us? That we present our bodies as living sacrifices to God in the divine service and in our daily life. We are to present our confession of faith as our offering of the name of Jesus. We are to present our prayers and our praises as God-pleasing offerings, and we are to present the offerings that were contributions that we make of money and other goods in the divine service. And then fifthly, we are to do good works as our God-pleasing offerings. Just a little aside here, I would like to alert your hearers to the importance of the phrase, you know, that something is well-pleasing or is pleasing to God. This harks back to Leviticus, where again and again you get the phrase that a particular offering is made with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. So the offerings that are pleasing to God are the ones that he himself institutes and establishes and requires of us. And we have such offerings in the New Testament.
Finally, let's talk about the priests, and in particular, how the priests explicitly in the New Testament, and namely the high priest himself, is shown to be, both in Leviticus and in the New Testament fulfillment, a type of Christ, if you will. Probably more emphasis in the book of Hebrews on how the Old Testament priesthood and the system of sacrifices instituted by God could never do what they were ultimately designed to do in and of themselves, but required this greater fulfillment toward which they proleptically pointed. Talk about the priesthood and his duty as Leviticus is discussed in the book of Hebrews, finally, with about 3 minutes.
Oh, there's a challenge for me. The priests were go-between people, mediators between God and the Israelites. They brought the people and their needs to God, and they brought God's blessing to the people. As part of their consecration, they had they were anointed with the anointing oil, and they had blood placed on their the thumbs of their right hand, so they could handle holy things, on the lobes of their right ears, so that they would listen to God's holy word, and on their feet, so that they could stand on holy ground. And then, as the culmination of their consecration, they were sprinkled with blood mixed with the holy anointing oil. So their bodies were made holy. But only the high priest was allowed to enter the holy place, the Holy of Holies, once a year. Normally, a priest only entered the holy place. The Israelites could only come to the courtyard. Now, Jesus is our high priest in the heavenly sanctuary. He goes where no high priest ever went in the Old Testament, not just once a year, but he ministers there day and night before God, interceding for us, blessing us, bringing God's gifts to us. And most remarkably, according to the book of Hebrews, every Christian who's been baptized, whose body has been washed with pure water, whose conscience has been cleansed, goes where no high priest ever went in the Old Testament. Every Christian in Holy Communion enters the heavenly sanctuary and stands together with Jesus before the presence of God the Father through the blood and the flesh of Jesus. Every Christian receives the most holy, sanctifying food that no priest ever ate in the Old Testament, the body and blood of Jesus. Now, this means that every Christian is part of God's royal priesthood. We're all called to mediate between God and the people of the world. Quite simply, every Sunday when I go to church, I bring the people that God has placed in my life to God and bring their needs to God and represent them before God. And then I receive God's blessing, the blessing of his holiness, and I take the triune God with me in my body as a temple out into my daily life. So, if you like, bridge heaven and earth together with Jesus for the sake of the people that we interact in within our station and vocation. We bring them and their needs to God the Father, and we bring the Father's blessing, the Holy Spirit, God's holiness, to the people that we meet with in our daily lives. That's the basic movement of our Christian lives.
Dr. John Kleinig is author of the Concordia Commentary on Leviticus. He serves at the Australian Lutheran College. Dr. Kleinig, I know our listeners are deeply devoted to you as one of our favorite guests, and I'm sure they've deeply enjoyed the 2 hours we've spent on the book of Leviticus with you. I know I have. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you very much, too. I pray that you will be kept awake to the very end. I don't know whether you realize we're just going into night here. It's about 10:30 here in Australia, but you're going into the day. I pray that the new day will bring much blessing for you and your listeners.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. We have what seems so obscure, doesn't it? It seems to be strange and foreign, all the strange practices, the rituals, the sacrifices, the offerings. They are many. Now, God is not just providing his Old Testament people with some sort of elaborate object lesson. While it does all teach them of the magnitude of sin and the greater magnitude of his mercy for the sake of Christ, he is not just teaching them something or demonstrating something to them in the Old Testament with that divine service. He is actually serving them in that divine service. He is bringing them the forgiveness of sins. They needed it too. And the great mercy of God does not wait for the final sacrifice to be made before he delivers the benefits of Christ's death on the cross to his Old Testament people of God. He delivers it to them too, even as they wait for it in time to be finally fulfilled. We on the other side of that cross, of that sacrifice, of that final sacrifice, receive the same benefits so that we are partakers along with them. They are partakers along with us of the same heavenly blessings. Isn't that what the writer to the Hebrews has to say? So all the blood and the gore and the burnt offerings and the smoke and all of the things that may terrify and mystify us about the Old Testament all find their fulfillment in the blood that Jesus shed at the cross and the sacrifice he made on the altar of the cross. Risen from the dead, he now stands as our great high priest before the Father with his blood in the holy place and pleads always, not just one day a year, but always with that atoning sacrifice interceding for us. This is our comfort. We are one with them, united in the sacrifice of Christ on the cross. Now, when we come back from this break, we're going to spend some time with Dr. Tim Cieleska talking about the book of Psalms. Is there any one message to these many different Psalms? We'll be right back.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We've talked the whole night through.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Good morning. Good morning. It's great to stay up late.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Hi, my name is David from Kansas City. And I'm privileged and blessed to go to a congregation that teaches the word clearly and ministers the sacraments rightly. And yet, what a blessing Issues, Etc. is between the Sundays of each week. From 1 week to another, we hear faithfully proclaimed in front of God in all its purity, clarity, and rightness, day in, day out, and whenever we need to hear it. Thanks to God for Pastor Wilkin and for Jeff Schwartz for their long-standing labor for the gospel, and for the care to get the gospel out all over the world, no matter where the boundaries which on the worldwide map do not exist, may be. So we thank God for them.
Well, we thank God for all of you. Those of you listening to us throughout these many hours of broadcast during Issues, Etc. 24, and we've got a great interview coming up with Dr. Tim Cieleska on the Book of Psalms. And we're also thankful we just went over, we reached 4,000 fans on our Issues Etc. Facebook fan page, facebook.com/ issuesetc.org or /issuesetc, facebook.com/issuesetc. 4,000 fans now on the Issues Etc. Facebook fan page. And while I'm there, Ellie in Williamsport, Vermont says, thanks so much for doing this, guys. You're doing great and praying for energy and clarity. Thanks so much, Ellie, for listening out there in the East Coast in Vermont. And thanks to everyone who's pledged so far to join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club, our monthly or annual giving program. You can do so by calling now 1-877-623-6943. issuesetc.org. Make a secure online donation there. Stipulate while you're doing the online donation that you want this to go towards the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. 877-623-6943, the Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
We just passed 8 a.m. Central Time here in Collinsville, and every 2 hours of our Bible study during Issues Etc. 24, we draw for a bundle pack, and we also draw for Pastor Matt Harrison's little book of joy that would accompany that bundle pack. We drew just a few minutes ago, and the winners this 2 hours are Bob and Cindy Myers of Milton, Florida. Congratulations.
And again, at the end of Issues Etc. 24, around 4 o'clock Central, we'll have a final drawing. Everybody who joins the Issues Etc. Reformation Club during Issues Etc. 24 will go into a drawing for 4 leather-bound Lutheran study Bibles. That's at 4 o'clock Central this afternoon at the completion of Issues Etc. 24. Please help support this Christ-centered, cross-focus outreach by joining our monthly or annual donor program, the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Issuesetc.org or 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Call now and pledge your support for the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc.